surrounded by ears and tongues. Doris immediately lowered her voice. I suppose you're right. Look around. All these smiling faces. And yet, who knows which of our friends will be reporting back to the head and his henchmen when the night is over? Ah, humans. Even after all these thousands of centuries, to think that such base treachery still exists. It seems to me to be so unnecessary, yet I know the harm it can do. That is why I must go with you, Harry. Impossible, Doris. It would just complicate matters for me. I'll go myself, and I'll have no trouble. You would have no idea how to handle the general. Selden looked grave. And you would? You sound exactly like Ilar. He too is convinced that I am a helpless old fool. He too wants to come with me, or rather to go in my place. I wonder how many people on Trantor are willing to take my place, he added with clear sarcasm. Dozens? Millions? Chapter 12. For 10 years the Galactic Empire had been without an emperor, but there was no indication of that fact in the way the Imperial Palace grounds were operated. Millennia of custom made the absence of an emperor meaningless. It meant, of course, that there was no figure in imperial robes to preside over formalities of one sort or another. No imperial voice gave orders. No imperial wishes made themselves known. No imperial gratifications or annoyances made themselves felt. No imperial pleasures warmed either palace. No imperial sicknesses cast them in gloom. The emperor's own quarters in the small palace were empty. The imperial family did not exist. And yet the army of gardeners kept the grounds in perfect condition. An army of service people kept the buildings in top shape. The emperor's bed, never slept in, was made with fresh sheets every day. The rooms were cleaned. Everything worked as it always worked, and the entire imperial staff, from top to bottom, worked as they had always worked. The top officials gave commands as they would have done if the emperor had lived, commands that they knew the emperor would have given. In many cases, in particular in the higher echelons, the personnel were the same as those who had been there on Cleon's last day of life. The new personnel who had been taken on were carefully molded and trained into the traditions they would have to serve. It was as though the Empire, accustomed to the rule of an emperor, insisted on this ghost rule to hold the Empire together. The junta knew this, or if they didn't, they felt it vaguely. In 10 years, none of those military men who had commanded the Empire had moved into the Emperor's private quarters in the small palace. Whatever these men were, they were not Imperial, and they knew they had no rights there. A populace that endured the loss of liberty would not endure any sign of irreverence to the Emperor, alive or dead. Even General Tenar had not moved into the graceful structure that had housed the Emperors of a dozen different dynasties for so long. He had made his home and office in one of the structures built on the outskirts of the grounds. Eyesores, but eyesores that were built like fortresses, sturdy enough to withstand a siege, with outlying buildings in which an enormous force of guards was housed. Tenar was a stocky man, with a mustache. It was not a vigorous, overflowing, doll-like mustache, but one that was carefully clipped and fitted to the upper lip, leaving a strip of skin between the hair and the line of the lip. It was a reddish mustache, and Tenar had cold blue eyes. He had probably been a handsome man in his younger days, but his face was pudgy now, and his eyes were slits that expressed anger more often than any other emotion. So he said angrily, as one would who felt himself to be absolute master of millions of worlds and yet who dared not call himself an emperor, to Hender Lin, "I can establish a dynasty of my own." He looked around with a scowl. "This is not a fitting place for the master of the empire." Lin said softly, "To be master is what is important. Better to be a master in a cubicle than a figurehead in a palace." "Best yet, to be master in a palace. Why not?" Lin bore the title of colonel, but it is quite certain that he had never engaged in any military action. His function was that of telling Tenar what he wanted to hear, and of carrying his orders unchanged to others. On occasion, if it seemed safe, he might try to steer Tenar into more prudent courses. Lin was well known as Tenar's lackey, and knew that was how he was known. It did not bother him. As lackey, he was safe, and he had seen the downfall of those who had been too proud to be lackeys. The time might, of course, come when Tenar himself would be buried in the ever-changing junta panorama, but Lin felt, with a certain amount of philosophy, that he would be aware of it in time and save himself. Or he might not. There was a price for everything. "No reason why you can't found a dynasty, General," said Lin. "Many others have done it in the long imperial history. Still, it takes time. The people are slow to adapt. It's usually only the second or even third of the dynasty who is fully accepted as emperor." "I don't believe that. I need merely announce myself as new emperor. Who will dare quarrel with that? My grip is tight." "So it is, General. Your power is unquestioned on Trantor and in most of the inner worlds. Yet it is possible that many in the farther outer worlds will not, just yet, accept a new imperial dynasty." "Inner worlds or outer worlds, military force rules all. That is an old imperial maxim."
"And a good one," said Lin. "But many of the provinces have armed forces of their own nowadays that they may not use on your behalf. These are difficult times."
"You counsel caution, then?"
"I always counsel caution, General."
"And someday you may counsel it once too often."
Lin bent his head. "I can only counsel what seems to me to be good and useful to you, General."
"As in your constant harping to me about this Harry Seldon."
"He is your greatest danger, General."
"So you keep saying, but I don't see it. He's just a college professor."
Lin said, "So he is, but he was once first minister."
"I know. But that was in Cleon's time. Has he done anything since? With times being difficult, and with the governors of the provinces being fractious, why is a professor my greatest danger?"
"It is sometimes a mistake," said Lin carefully, for one had to be careful in educating the general, "to suppose that a quiet, unobtrusive man can be harmless. Seldon has been anything but harmless to those he has opposed. 20 years ago, the Joranumite movement almost destroyed Cleon's powerful first minister, Ato Demerzel." Tenar nodded, but the slight frown on his face betrayed his effort to remember the matter. "It was Seldon who destroyed Joranum and who succeeded Demerzel as first minister. The Joranumite movement survived, however, and Seldon engineered its destruction too, but not before it succeeded in bringing about the assassination of Cleon."
"But Seldon survived that, didn't he?"
"You are perfectly correct. Seldon survived."
"That is strange. To have permitted an imperial assassination should have meant death for a first minister.
So it should have. Nevertheless, the junta has allowed him to live. It seemed wiser to do so.
Why?
Lin sighed internally. There is something called psychohistory, General.
I know nothing about that, said Tenar flatly.
Actually, he had a vague memory of Lin trying to talk to him on a number of occasions concerning this strange collection of syllables. He had never wanted to listen, and Lin had known better than to push the matter. Tenar didn't want to listen now, either, but there seemed to be a hidden urgency in Lin's words. Perhaps, Tenar thought, he had now better listen.
Almost no one knows anything about it, said Lin. Yet there are a few, intellectuals who find it of interest.
And what is it?
It is a complex system of mathematics.
Tenar shook his head.
Leave me out of that, please. I can count my military divisions. That's all the mathematics I need.
The story is, said Lin, that psychohistory may make it possible to predict the future.
The general's eyes bulged.
You mean this Selden is a fortune teller?
Not in the usual fashion. It is a matter of science.
I don't believe it.
It is hard to believe, but Selden has become something of a cult figure here on Trentor, and in certain places in the outer worlds. Now, psychohistory, if it can be used to predict the future, or if even people merely think it can be so used, can be a powerful tool with which to uphold the regime. I'm sure you have already seen this, General. One need merely predict our regime will endure and bring forth peace and prosperity for the Empire. People believing this will help make it a self-fulfilling prophecy. On the other hand, if Selden wishes the reverse, he can predict civil war and ruin. People will believe that, too, and that would destabilize the regime.
In that case, Colonel, we simply make sure that the predictions of psychohistory are what we want them to be.
It would be Selden who would have to make them, and he is not a friend of the regime. It is important, General, that we differentiate between the project that is working at Streeling University to perfect psychohistory and Harry Selden. Psychohistory can be extremely useful to us, but it will be so only if someone other than Selden were in charge.
Are there others who could be?
Oh, yes. It is only necessary to get rid of Selden.
What is so difficult with that? An order of execution, and it is done.
It would be better, General, if the government was not seen to be directly involved in such a thing.
Explain.
I have arranged to have him meet with you so that you can use your skill to probe his personality. You would then be able to judge whether certain suggestions I have in mind are worthwhile or not.
When is the meeting to take place?
It was to take place very soon, but his representatives at the project asked for a few days' leeway because they were in the process of celebrating his birthday. His 60th, apparently. It seemed wise to allow that and to permit a week's delay.
Why? Demanded Tenar. I dislike any display of weakness.
Quite right, General. Quite right. Your instincts are, as always, correct. However, it seemed to me that the needs of the state might require us to know what and how the birthday celebration, which is taking place right now, might involve.
Why?
All knowledge is useful. Would you care to see some of the festivities?
General Tenar's face remained dark.
Is that necessary?
I think you will find it interesting, General. The reproduction, sight and sound, was excellent, and for quite a while the hilarity of the birthday celebration filled the rather stark room in which the General sat. Lin's low voice served as commentary. Most of this, General, is taking place in the project complex, but the rest of the university is involved. We will have an air view in a few moments, and you will see that the celebration covers a wide area. In fact, though I don't have the evidence available right now, there are corners of the planet, here and there in various university and sectoral settings mostly, where what we might call sympathy celebrations of one sort or another are taking place. The celebrations are still continuing, and will endure for another day at least.
Are you telling me that this is a Trantor-wide celebration?
In a specialized way. It affects mostly the intellectual classes, but it is surprisingly widespread. It may even be that there is some shouting on worlds other than Trantor.
Where did you get this reproduction?
Lin smiled. Our facilities in the project are quite good. We have reliable sources of information, so that little can happen that doesn't come our way at once.
Well then, Lin, what are all your conclusions about this?
It seems to me, General, and I'm sure that it seems so to you, that Harry Seldon is the focus of a personality cult. He has so identified himself with psychohistory that if we were to get rid of him in too open a manner, we would entirely destroy the credibility of the science. It would be useless to us. On the other hand, General, Seldon is growing old, and it is not difficult to imagine him being replaced by another man, someone we could choose, and who would be friendly to our great aims and hopes for the Empire. If Seldon could be removed in such a way that it is made to seem natural, then that is all we need.
The General said, "And you think I ought to see him?"
"Yes, in order to weigh his quality and decide what we ought to do. But we must be cautious, for he is a popular man."
"I have dealt with popular people before," said Tenar darkly.
Chapter 13. "Yes," said Harry Seldon wearily, "it was a great triumph. I had a wonderful time. I can hardly wait until I'm 70 so I can repeat it. But the fact is, I'm exhausted." "So get yourself a good night's sleep, Dad," said Rach, smiling. "That's an easy cure." "I don't know how well I can relax when I have to see our great leader in a few days."
"Not alone you won't see him," said Doris Van Ebbele grimly.
Seldon frowned. "Don't say that again, Doris. It is important for me to see him alone."
"It won't be safe with you alone. Do you remember what happened 10 years ago when you refused to let me come with you to greet the gardeners?"
"There is no danger of my forgetting when you remind me of it twice a week, Doris. In this case, though, I intend to go alone. What can he want to do to me if I come in as an old man, utterly harmless, to find out what he wants?"
"What do you imagine he wants?" said Rach, biting at his knuckle. "I suppose he wants what Cleon always wanted. It will turn out that he has found out that psychohistory can in some way predict the future, and he will want to use it for his own purposes. I told Cleon the science wasn't up to it nearly 30 years ago, and I kept telling him that all through my tenure as First Minister. And now I'll have to tell General Tenar the same thing."
"How do you know he'll believe you?" said Rach. "I'll think of some way of being convincing." Doris said,
I do not wish you to go alone.
Your wishing doors makes no difference.
At this point, Temuel Ilar interrupted. He said, I'm the only non-family person here. I don't know if a comment from me would be welcome.
Go ahead, said Selden. Come one, come all.
I would like to suggest a compromise. Why don't a number of us go with the maestro, quite a few of us? We can act as his triumphal escort, a kind of finale to the birthday celebration. Now wait, I don't mean that we will all crowd into the general's offices. I don't even mean entering the Imperial Palace grounds. We can just take hotel rooms in the Imperial sector at the edge of the grounds. The Dome's Edge Hotel would be just right, and we'll give ourselves a day of pleasure.
That's just what I need, snorted Selden. A day of pleasure.
Not you, Maestro, said Ilar at once. You'll be meeting with General Tenar. The rest of us, though, will give the people of the Imperial Sector a notion of your popularity, and perhaps the General will take note also. And if he knows we're all waiting for your return, it may keep him from being unpleasant.
There was a considerable silence after that. Finally, Raich said, It sounds too showy to me. It don't fit in with the image the world has of Dad. But Doors said, I'm not interested in Harry's image. I'm interested in Harry's safety. It strikes me that if we cannot invade the General's presence or the Imperial grounds, then allowing ourselves to accumulate, so to speak, as near the General as we can, might do us well. Thank you, Dr. Ilar, for a very good suggestion.
I don't want it done, said Selden.
But I do, said Doors. And if that's as close as I can get to offering you personal protection, then that much I will insist on.
Manella, who had listened to it all without comment till then, said,
Visiting the Dome's Edge Hotel could be a lot of fun.
It's not fun I'm thinking of, said Doors, but I'll accept your vote in favor.
And so it was. The following day, some 20 of the higher echelon of the Psychohistory Project descended on the Dome's Edge Hotel, with rooms overlooking the open spaces of the Imperial Palace grounds. The following evening, Harry Selden was picked up by the General's armed guards and taken off to the meeting. At almost the same time, Doris Van Eboli disappeared, but her absence was not noted for a long time. And when it was noted, no one could guess what had happened to her, and the gaily festive mood turned rapidly into apprehension.
Chapter 14 Doris Van Eboli had lived on the Imperial Palace grounds for 10 years. As wife of the First Minister, she had entry to the grounds and could pass freely from the dome to the open, with her fingerprints as the pass. In the confusion that followed Cleon's assassination, her pass had never been removed. And now, when, for the first time since that dreadful day, she wanted to move from the dome into the open spaces of the grounds, she could do so. She had always known that she could do so easily only once, for upon discovery the pass would be cancelled. But this was the one time to do it. There was a sudden darkening of the sky as she moved into the open, and she felt a distinct lowering of the temperature. The world under the dome was always kept a little lighter during the night period than natural night would require, and was kept a little dimmer during the day period. And, of course, the temperature beneath the dome was always a bit milder than the outdoors. Most Trentorians were unaware of this, for they spent their entire lives under the dome. To Doris, it was expected, but it didn't really matter. She took the central roadway, into which the dome opened, at the site of the Dome's Edge Hotel.
It was, of course, brightly lit, so that the darkness of the sky didn't matter at all. Doris knew that she would not advance 100 meters along the roadway without being stopped, less perhaps in the present paranoid days of the junta. Her alien presence would be detected at once. Nor was she disappointed. A small ground car skittered up, and the guardsman shouted out the window, "What are you doing here? Where are you going?" Doris ignored the question and continued to walk. The guardsman called out, "Halt!" Then he slammed on the brakes and stepped out of the car, which was exactly what Doris had wanted him to do. The guardsman was holding a blaster loosely in his hand, not threatening to use it, merely demonstrating its existence. He said, "Your reference number." Doris said, "I want your car." "What?" The guardsman sounded outraged. "Your reference number, immediately." And now the blaster came up. Doris said quietly, "You don't need my reference number." Then she walked toward the guardsman. The guardsman took a backward step. "If you don't stop and present your reference number, I'll blast you." "No. Drop your blaster." The guardsman's lips tightened. His finger began to edge toward the contact. But before he could reach it, he was lost. He could never describe afterward what happened in any accurate way. All he could say was, "How was I to know it was the Tiger Woman?" All he could say was, "How was I to know it was the Tiger Woman?" The time came when he would be proud of the encounter. "She moved so fast, I didn't see exactly what she did or what happened. One moment I was going to shoot her down. I was sure she was some sort of mad woman. And the next thing I knew, I was completely overwhelmed." Doris held the guardsman in a firm grip, the hand with the blaster forced high. She said, "Either drop the blaster at once, or I will break your arm." The guardsman felt a kind of death grip around his chest that all but prevented him from breathing. Realizing he had no choice, he dropped the blaster. Doris Venebile released him. But before the guardsman could make a move to recover, he found himself facing his own blaster in Doris' hand. Doris said, "I hope you've left your detectors in place. Don't try to report what's happened too quickly. You had better wait and decide what it is you plan to tell your superiors. The fact that an unarmed woman took your blaster and your car may well put an end to your usefulness to the junta." Doris started the car and began to speed down the central roadway. A 10-year stay on the grounds told her exactly where she was going. The car she was in, an official ground car, was not an alien intrusion into the grounds and would not be picked up as a matter of course. However, she had to take a chance on speed, for she wanted to reach her destination rapidly. She pushed the car to a speed of 200 kilometers per hour. The speed, at least, eventually did attract attention. She ignored radioed cries, demanding to know why she was speeding, and before long the car's detectors told her that another ground car was in hot pursuit. She knew that there would be a warning sent up ahead, and that there would be other ground cars waiting for her to arrive. But there was little any of them could do short of trying to blast her out of existence, something apparently no one was willing to try, pending further investigation. When she reached the building she had been heading for, two ground cars were waiting for her. She climbed serenely out of her own car and walked toward the entrance. Two men at once stood in her way, obviously astonished that the driver of the speeding car was not a guardsman, but a woman dressed in civilian clothes. "What are you doing here? What was the rush?" Doris said quietly, Important message for Colonel Hender Lynn.
Is that so? Said the guardsman harshly. There were now four men between her and the entrance. Reference number, please.
Doris said, Don't delay me.
Reference number, I said.
You're wasting my time.
One of the guardsmen said suddenly, You know who she looks like? The old First Minister's wife, Dr. Venebeli, the Tiger Woman. There was an odd backward step on the part of all four, but one of them said, You're under arrest.
Am I? Said Doris.
If I'm the Tiger Woman, you must know that I am considerably stronger than any of you, and that my reflexes are considerably faster. Let me suggest that all four of you accompany me quietly inside, and we'll see what Colonel Lynn has to say.
You're under arrest, came the repetition, and four blasters were aimed at Doris.
Well, said Doris, if you insist.
She moved rapidly, and two of the guardsmen were suddenly on the ground groaning, while Doris was standing with a blaster in each hand. She said,
I have tried not to hurt them, but it is quite possible that I have broken their wrists. That leaves two of you, and I can shoot faster than you can. If either of you makes the slightest move, the slightest, I will have to break the habit of a lifetime and kill you. It will sicken me to do so, and I beg you not to force me into it.
There was absolute silence from the two guardsmen still standing. No motion.
I would suggest, said Doris, that you two escort me into the colonel's presence, and that you then seek medical help for your comrades.
The suggestion was not necessary. Colonel Lynn emerged from his office. What is going on here? What is... Doris turned to him.
Ah, let me introduce myself. I am Dr. Doris Venebeli, the wife of Professor Harry Selden. I have come to see you on important business. These four tried to stop me, and as a result, two are badly hurt. Send them all about their business and let me talk to you. I mean you no harm.
Lynn stared at the four guardsmen, then at Doris. He said calmly, You mean me no harm? Though four guardsmen have not succeeded in stopping you, I have 4,000 at my instant call.
Then call them, said Doris. However quickly they come, it will not be in time to save you, should I decide to kill you. Dismiss your guardsmen, and let us talk civilly.
Lynn dismissed the guardsman and said, Well, come in, and we will talk. Let me warn you, though, Dr. Venebeli, I have a long memory.
And I, said Doris.
They walked into Lynn's quarters together. Chapter 15 Lynn said with utmost courtesy, Tell me exactly why you are here, Dr. Venebeli. Doris smiled without menace, and yet not exactly pleasantly either.
To begin with, she said, I have come here to show you that I can come here.
Ah?
Yes. My husband was taken to his interview with the general in an official ground car under armed guard. I myself left the hotel at about the same time he did, on foot and unarmed. And here I am. And I believe I got here before he did. I had to wade through 5 guardsmen, including the guardsman whose car I appropriated, in order to reach you. I would have waded through 50.
Lynn nodded his head phlegmatically. I understand that you are sometimes called the Tiger Woman.
I have been called that. Now, having reached you, My task is to make certain that no harm comes to my husband. He is venturing into the general's lair, if I can be dramatic about it, and I want him to emerge unharmed and unthreatened. As far as I am concerned, I know that no harm will come to your husband as a result of this meeting. But if you are concerned, why do you come to me? Why didn't you go directly to the general? Because of the two of you, it is you that has the brains. There was a short pause, and Lin said, "That would be a most dangerous remark, if overheard." "More dangerous for you than for me, so make sure it is not overheard. Now, if it occurs to you that I am to be simply soothed and put off, and that if my husband is imprisoned or marked for execution, that there will really be nothing I can do about it, disabuse yourself." She indicated the two blasters that lay on the table before her. "I entered the grounds with nothing. I arrived in your immediate vicinity with two blasters. If I had no blasters, I might have had knives, with which I am an expert. And if I had neither blasters nor knives, I would still be a formidable person. This table we're sitting at is metal, obviously, and sturdy."
"It is."
Doris held up her hands, fingers splayed, as if to show that she held no weapon. Then she dropped them to the table, and palms down caressed its surface. Abruptly, Doris raised her fist and then brought it down on the table with a loud crash, which sounded almost as if metal were striking metal. She smiled and lifted her hand. "No bruise," Doris said. "No pain. But you'll notice that the table is slightly bent where I struck it. If that same blow had come down with the same force on a person's head, the skull would have exploded. I have never done such a thing. In fact, I have never killed anyone, though I have injured several. Nevertheless, if Professor Selden is harmed..."
"You are still threatening."
"I am promising. I will do nothing if Professor Selden is unharmed. Otherwise, Colonel Lin, I will be forced to maim or kill you, and, I promise you again, I will do the same to General Tenar."
Lin said, "You cannot withstand an entire army, no matter how tigerish a woman you are. What then?"
"Stories spread," said Doris, "and are exaggerated. I have not really done much in the way of tigerishness, but many more stories are told of me than are true. Your guardsmen fell back when they recognized me, and they themselves will spread the story, with advantage, of how I made my way to you. Even an army might hesitate to attack me, Colonel Lin. But even if they did, and even if they destroyed me, beware the indignation of the people. The junta is maintaining order, but it is doing so only barely, and you don't want anything to upset matters. Think then of how easy the alternative is. Simply do not harm Professor Harry Selden."
"We have no intention of harming him."
"Why the interview, then?"
"What's the mystery? The general is curious about psychohistory. The government records are open to us. The old Emperor Cleon was interested. Demerzel, when he was First Minister, was interested. Why should we not be in our turn? In fact, more so."
"Why more so?"
"Because time has passed.
As I understand it, psychohistory began as a thought in Professor Selden's mind. He has been working on it, with increasing vigor and with larger and larger groups of people, for nearly 30 years. He has done so almost entirely with government support, so that, in a way, his discoveries and techniques belong to the government. We intend to ask him about psychohistory, which by now must be far advanced beyond what existed in the times of Demerzel and Cleon, and we expect him to tell us what we want to know. We want something more practical than the vision of equations curling their way through air. Do you understand me?
Yes, said Doris, frowning.
And one more thing. Do not suppose that the danger to your husband comes from the government only, and that any harm that reaches him will mean that you must attack us at once. I would suggest that Professor Selden may have purely private enemies. I have no knowledge of such things, but surely it is possible.
I shall keep that in mind. Right now, I want to have you arrange that I join my husband during his interview with the general. I want to know beyond doubt that he is safe.
That will be hard to arrange and will take some time. It would be impossible to interrupt the conversation, but if you wait till it is ended,
take the time and arrange it.
Do not count on double-crossing me and remaining alive. Chapter 16. General Tenar stared at Harry Selden in a rather pop-eyed manner, and his fingers tapped lightly at the desk where he sat.
30 years, he said. 30 years, and you are telling me you still have nothing to show for it?
Actually, General, 28 years.
Tenar ignored that. And all at government expense. Do you know how many billions of credits have been invested in your project, Professor?
I haven't kept up, General, but we have records that could give me the answer to your question in seconds.
And so have we. The government, Professor, is not an endless source of funds. These are not the old times. We don't have Cleon's old free and easy attitude toward finances. Raising taxes is hard, and we need credits for many things. I have called you here, hoping that you can benefit us in some way with your psychohistory. If you cannot, then I must tell you, quite frankly, that we will have to shut off the faucet. If you can continue your research without government funding, do so. For unless you show me something that would make the expense worth it, you will have to do just that.
General, you make a demand I cannot meet. But if in response you end government support, you will be throwing away the future. Give me time, and eventually...
Various governments have heard that eventually from you for decades. Isn't it true, Professor, that you say your psychohistory predicts that the junta is unstable, that my rule is unstable, that in a short time it will collapse?
Selden frowned. The technique is not yet firm enough for me to say that this is something that psychohistory states.
I put it to you that psychohistory does state it, and that this is common knowledge within your project.
No, said Selden warmly, no such thing. It is possible that some among us have interpreted some relationships to indicate that the junta may be an unstable form of government, but there are other relationships that may easily be interpreted to show it is stable. That is the reason why we must continue our work. At the present moment, it is all too easy to use incomplete data and imperfect reasoning to reach any conclusion we wish.
But if you decide to present the conclusion that the government is unstable and say that psychohistory warrants it, even if it does not actually do so, will it not add to the instability?
It may very well do that, General. And if we announce that the government is stable, it may well add to the stability. I have had this very same discussion with Emperor Cleon on a number of occasions. It is possible to use psychohistory as a tool to manipulate the emotions of the people
and achieve short-term effects. In the long run, however, the predictions are quite likely to prove incomplete or downright erroneous, and psychohistory will lose all its credibility, and it will be as though it had never existed.
Enough. Tell me straight out. What do you think psychohistory shows about my government?
It shows, we think, that there are elements of instability in it. But we are not certain, and cannot be certain, exactly in what way this can be made worse or made better.
In other words, psychohistory simply tells you what you would know without psychohistory, and it is that in which government has invested uncounted piles of credits.
The time will come when psychohistory will tell us what we could not know without it, and then the investment will pay itself back many, many times over.
And how long will it be before that time comes?
Not too long, I hope. We have been making rather gratifying progress in the last few years.
Tenar was tapping his fingernail on the desk again.
Not enough. Tell me something helpful now. Something useful.
Selden pondered, then said, I can prepare a detailed report for you, but it will take time.
Of course it will. Days, months, years, and somehow it will never be written. Do you take me for a fool?
No, of course not, General. However, I don't want to be taken for a fool either. I can tell you something that I will take sole responsibility for. I have seen it in my psychohistorical research, but I may have misinterpreted what I saw. However, since you insist...
I insist.
You mentioned taxes a little while ago. You said raising taxes was difficult. Certainly, it is always difficult. Every government must do its work by collecting wealth in one form or another. The only two ways in which such credits can be obtained are first, by robbing a neighbor, or second, persuading a government's own citizens to grant the credits willingly and peaceably. Since we have established a galactic empire that has been conducting its business in reasonable fashion for thousands of years, there is no possibility of robbing a neighbor, except as the result of an occasional rebellion and its repression. This does not happen often enough to support a government. And if it did, the government would be too unstable to last long in any case.
Selden drew a deep breath and went on. Therefore, credits must be raised by asking the citizens to hand over part of their wealth for government use. Presumably, since the government will then work efficiently, the citizens can better spend their credits in this way than to hoard it, each man to himself, while living in a dangerous and chaotic anarchy. However, though the request is reasonable and the citizenry is better off paying taxes as their price for maintaining a stable and efficient government, they are nevertheless reluctant to do so. In order to overcome this reluctance, governments must make it appear that they are not taking too many credits, and that they are considering each citizen's rights and benefits. In other words, they must lower the percentage taken out of low incomes, they must allow deductions of various kinds to be made before the tax is assessed, and so on. As time goes on, the tax situation inevitably grows more and more complex, as different worlds, different sectors within each world, and different economic divisions all demand and require special treatment. The result is that the tax-collecting branch of the government grows in size and complexity and tends to become uncontrollable. The average citizen cannot understand why or how much he is being taxed, what he can get away with and what he can't. The government and the tax agency itself are often in the dark as well. What's more, An ever larger fraction of the funds collected must be put into running the over-elaborate tax agency, maintaining records, pursuing tax delinquents. So the amount of credits available for good and useful purposes declines despite anything we can do. In the end, the tax situation becomes overwhelming. It inspires discontent and rebellion. The history books tend to ascribe these things to greedy businessmen, to corrupt politicians, to brutal warriors, to ambitious viceroys. But these are just the individuals who take advantage of the tax overgrowth. The general said harshly,
"Are you telling me that our tax system is overcomplicated?"
Selden said, "If it were not, it would be the only one in history that wasn't, as far as I know. If there is one thing that psychohistory tells me is inevitable, it is tax overgrowth."
"And what do we do about it?"
"That I cannot tell you. It is that for which I would like to prepare a report that, as you say, may take a while to get ready."
"Never mind the report. The tax system is overcomplicated, isn't it? Isn't that what you're saying?"
"It is possible that it is," said Selden cautiously.
"And to correct that, one must make the tax system simpler. As simple as possible, in fact."
"I would have to study."
"Nonsense. The opposite of great complication is great simplicity. I don't need a report to tell me that."
"As you say, General," said Selden. At this point, the General looked up suddenly, as though he had been called, as indeed he had been. His fists clenched, and holovision images of Colonel Lynn and Doris Venneboli suddenly appeared in the room. Thunderstruck, Selden exclaimed, "Doris, what are you doing here?" The General said nothing, but his brow furrowed into a frown. Chapter 17. The General had had a bad night, and so, out of apprehension, had the Colonel. They faced each other now, each at a loss. The General said,
"Tell me again what this woman did."
Lynn seemed to have a heavy weight on his shoulders.
"She's the Tiger Woman, that's what they call her. She doesn't seem to be quite human somehow. She's some sort of impossibly trained athlete, full of self-confidence. And, General, she's quite frightening."
"Did she frighten you, a single woman?"
"Let me tell you exactly what she did, and let me tell you a few other things about her. I don't know how true all the stories about her are, but what happened yesterday evening is true enough." He told the story again, and the General listened, puffing out his cheeks.
"Bad," he said. "What do we do?"
"I think our course is plain before us. We want psychohistory."
"Yes, we do," said the General. "Selden told me something about taxation that... But never mind. That is beside the point at the moment. Go on."
Lynn, who in his troubled state of mind had allowed a small fragment of impatience to show on his face, continued. "As I say, we want psychohistory without Selden. He is, in any case, a used-up man. The more I study him, the more I see an elderly scholar who is living on his past deeds. He has had nearly 30 years to make a success of psychohistory, and he has failed. Without him, with new men at the helm, psychohistory may advance more rapidly."
"Yes, I agree. Now, what about the woman?"
"Well, there you are. We haven't taken her into consideration because she has been careful to remain in the background. But I strongly suspect now
that it will be difficult, perhaps impossible, to remove Selden quietly and without implicating the government as long as the woman remains alive.
Do you really believe that she will mangle you and me if she thinks we have harmed her man?
Said the general, his mouth twisting in contempt.
I really think she will, and that she will start a rebellion as well. It will be exactly as she promised.
You are turning into a coward.
General, please, I am trying to be sensible. I'm not backing off. We must take care of this tiger woman. He paused thoughtfully.
As a matter of fact, my sources have told me this, and I admit to having paid far too little attention to the matter.
And how do you think we can get rid of her?
Lin said,
I don't know.
Then, more slowly,
but someone else might.
Chapter 18. Selden had had a bad night also, nor was a new day promising to be much better. There weren't too many times when Harry felt annoyed with Doors, but this time he was very annoyed. He said,
What a foolish thing to do. Wasn't it enough that we were all staying at the Dome's Edge Hotel? That alone would have been sufficient to drive a paranoid ruler into thoughts of some sort of conspiracy.
How? We were unarmed, Harry. It was a holiday affair, the final touch of your birthday celebration. We posed no threat.
Yes, but then you carried out your invasion of the palace grounds. It was unforgivable. You raced to the palace to interfere with my session with the general when I had specifically, and several times, made it plain that I didn't want you there. I had my own plans, you know.
Doris said,
Your desires and your orders and your plans all take second place to your safety. I was primarily concerned about that.
I was in no danger.
That is not something I can carelessly assume. There have been two attempts on your life. What makes you think there won't be a third?
The two attempts were made when I was First Minister. I was probably worth killing then. Who would want to kill an elderly mathematician?
Doris said,
That's exactly what I want to find out, and that's what I want to stop. I must begin by doing some questioning right here at the project.
No, you will simply be upsetting my people. Leave them alone.
That's exactly what I can't do, Harry. My job is to protect you, and for 28 years I've been working at that. You cannot stop me now.
Something in the blaze of her eyes made it quite clear that whatever Selden's desires or orders might be, Doris intended to do as she pleased. Selden's safety came first.
Chapter 19.
May I interrupt you, Hugo?
Of course, Doris, said Hugo Amaryll with a large smile. You are never an interruption. What can I do for you?
I am trying to find out a few things, Hugo, and I wonder if you would humor me in this.
If I can.
You have something in the project called the Prime Radiant. I hear of it now and then. Harry speaks of it, so I imagine I know what it looks like when it's activated. But I have never actually seen it in operation. I would like to.
Amaryll looked uncomfortable.
Actually, the Prime Radiant is just about the most closely guarded part of the project, and you aren't on the list of members who have access.
I know that, but we've known each other for 28 years.
And you're Harry's wife. I suppose we can stretch a point.
We only have two full prime radiants. There's one in Harry's office, and one here. Right there, in fact.